Joe, good morning.
Hey, Steve. How you doing?
I'm good.
How come you didn't have me on to talk about the fun subjects?
Well, listen, that's the life you've chosen.
Okay, Tom Hagen.
The situation, I can't laugh about it because, the attempt by the Labor Department and state agencies now taking their turn at the New York backstretch. Explain, Joe, how people need to understand this. It just so happens Gary Gullo was with me on Monday when the headlines were fresh, and so I asked Gary to react, and he, I thought he was terrific about it. Some people tried to make light of your response, your press release and your statement. Explain so people understand what is really happening in all of this.
Well, there's actually a bunch of things going on. Let me start from where I think the beginning is that the trainers are being buffeted by two kind of opposing forces. You have a federal Department of Labor who is trying to restrict the use of properly visaed workers who come here from many Latin American countries, Mexico in particular. So you have the federal DOL cracking down on people, trying to keep them from using those workers. And that's, I don't think I'm saying anything controversial. The president makes it quite clear that he'd like to see less foreign workers in this country. And for all of us in our business and in agriculture and in hospitality businesses, we understand that they're the backbone of all those businesses. So that's the first part. The second part is New York is very different from the federal government. The New York Department of Labor is trying to make sure that every single worker is paid the appropriate wage. And as you know, in New York, we've had a lot of changes in the last few years, changes to labor law, changes to the makeup of our legislature. So, they've taken an extremely aggressive approach, and many of our trainers have been caught in the vice. So, people can make light of me, but or make a statement, but the fact of the matter is that we're trying to convert an industry that's been agrarian, rural, agricultural, name it what you want, and bring it into the modern, into modern best practices, and it hasn't been easy. And no one's here defending every trainer, defending every instance, but what we're trying to do is set in the context of what's going on. For generations, people at the track have been paid a certain way, not below minimum wage, but on a weekly basis. And quite honestly, that's not going to fly from a compliance standpoint anymore. And our trainers are, struggling to adapt to that and to all the compliance issues that they need to confront. Things like split shift work, things like varying wages. I'll give you an example. The wage rate at Belmont is different than the wage rate at Aqueduct.
Gullo explained that.
Yes. So you have two different wage rates. However, we're on state. So the difference between, let's say, a restaurant, a store, a shop, Macy's, whatever, is that those businesses are free to do business wherever they want, right? They can set up their business wherever they want. A trainer is essentially warehoused at Belmont and for about half the year must race at Aqueduct. So you have two different wage rates in the same day frequently for multiple employees. Now guys can be skeptical and say, hey, life's tough. Small business is tough. You need to work that out. And the guys are, and we're getting there. And, we had 367 trainers operate in New York last year, and they announced charges on six. or not even charges, settlements with sex. So, you know, so there's a lot of kind of complicated wage and labor laws that weren't designed with horse racing in mind, let alone horse racing on a government-sanctioned property. And, you know, we're working hard to get everyone there, but it doesn't come, you know, it doesn't come so quickly.
The vitriol and the real nasty posture of the government press releases and Cuomo's office, like they're hanging skins on the wall, and like they've uncovered some great injustice. That's to me a little over the top. I mean, has that been addressed with anybody? I mean, why do they feel it's so necessary to merchandise this, you know, so that the public can easily turn around and say, oh, look, these filthy scum, you know, I'm sure you by now you've read this unbelievable Tom Noonan stupidity that was... I mean, to me, I'm not an attorney. I would think it's almost actionable what he wrote. But it's like, well, am I wrong?
Well, I don't. You said a lot there, so I don't know exactly what the question is. But let me phrase it more like this. Sadly, and I say this about a lot of things. Sadly, the only people that really care are the people who observe our industry on a daily basis, right? We're a niche sport. I don't think the public beyond our readership, beyond your listeners, is really paying attention to us. Okay, I think that's the first thing. I don't read. I try not to read too many blogs or things like that because I find them warping. So I don't know what that guy said, but yeah, I think we live in a time of hyper-partisanship right now where, you know, people want to be seen as protecting the workers, quote-unquote the workers. And I think that's, you know, that's the world we live in right now. And, you know, I hate it when my people are on the end of that, but, you know, that's... We all have to be adults about it and know what's going on in the world beyond racing.
One of the things I thought the quote from Linda Rice was also kind of interesting, that it doesn't appear that, knock on wood, that other jurisdictions are dealing with this pressure.
Well, I think the other jurisdictions outside New York have, you know, certainly different governance, although that just changed in Kentucky, right? Like, we shouldn't, again, Steve, we're so focused on our industry, but we got to realize what's going on in the rest of the world, right? So let's look at Kentucky and Florida, right? Like, two main eastern or midwestern and eastern states. You have, you know, extremely conservative Republican governors in those states, and they're not apt to do that sort of thing. Now, the governor in Kentucky is going to change. We'll see what changes are there. But, you know, this is the bigger world that we live in, and we're not going to be able to be cocooned anymore. I think Linda was really focused and right on in her comments. And I know a lot of our guys have spent a lot of time invested in trying to get up to speed and trying to comply as best they can.
Well, and you know, that's the message that we tried to drive home with the conversation with Gary. Actually came up again yesterday, and you know, it to me it feels like I don't want to say low hanging fruit, but it just feels like you know, trying to, you know, take advantage of, you know, of a situation that doesn't have the motivations that are being advertised, you know, by those that are prosecuting, quote unquote.
So we certainly would agree with that, and we wish the Department of Labor would work with us more, so we could make sure we get everyone there. You know, we just to give people an idea, NYSA brings in lawyers, we bring in employment experts to help our people. But you know, these laws are complicated, and sometimes we're flying blind. And if we could get more assistance from these or from the governmental organizations, it really would have been beneficial. Now, having said that, everyone should realize in New York, we're doing about $45 million in backstretch payroll per year. $45 million. And when you look at the size of the disputed pay, it's a small percentage of that, an extremely small percentage. So I think the overall message is many, many of our trainers are getting in compliance or have been in compliance and haven't been under the scrutiny. So the impression that, this is widespread and vast, et cetera, it's just not the case.
I wanted to get that point driven home. And Joe, while we're together, some reaction from your vantage point toward the advancement of this Thoroughbred Safety Coalition and the initiatives. I mean, you're as part of a THA, and Alan Foreman was with me last Friday. A lot of the initiatives here that were announced the other day, you're intimately familiar with from, NYTHA practice and being involved with the Mid-Atlantic plan. What are your thoughts about how this is going to work and what elements, other elements of the industry might need to be included in regards to stakeholders?
Well, I'm sure I'm going to blow this quote, but I think they said, like, mimicry is the best form of flattery, right? So we're thrilled that the industry at large is seizing on elements of the Mid-Atlantic plan. And I couldn't be happier that the major tracks are coming together to advance these efforts, right? Like, it's a long time coming. It's overdue. It's wonderful. I think you're going to have to include all the industry stakeholders if you're going to be effective in actually executing. And that's really the key to all of this, is how are you going to execute? Who's going to own this effort? Who's going to do all the hard work of going around state by state, getting commissions to pass regulations, getting other tracks on board, right? That's really the question. And I'm excited that the tracks are interested in doing this. And I thought it was a very positive first step. Now the real work begins.
Well, and some of this is going to overlap with other areas. I mean, to me, that have already been addressed. I mean, I saw where some people took it as an occasion to ridicule NTRA's initiatives and the Safety and Integrity Task Force, which actually pushed the peanut in a lot of positive directions, some of which probably will touch on areas here. I mean, these are overlapping, in some cases overlapping issues, but if you have large percentages of jurisdictions on the same page and all having the same mission and the same goals, it goes a long way toward the things that we'd like to achieve.
It sure does. And look, we know the industries Twitterati, let's call them, are quick to ridicule basically everything, okay? But they should read the NTRA Safety and Integrity Alliance plan. They should look at some of those reports. They're quite comprehensive. And this all is part and parcel of a similar effort. I think the tracks are trying to show leadership, which is a great thing, right? We bemoan them for not showing leadership, and then when they go out and show leadership, people say, oh, it's not good enough, okay? So this is the first step. We need to integrate all these safety plans into, quite frankly, a national agenda, right? What are the best practices that are going to be employed at our tracks? And a lot of it will come from that NTRA Safety and Integrity Alliance. A lot of it will come from plans like the Mid-Atlantic. A lot of it will come from the tracks themselves. But we need one plan, one focus, and one effort at compliance and certification. And I think this is the first step along those lines. And, you know, look, the proof is always in the pudding. Everyone, you know, you can always sell the announcement, but then you got to roll up your sleeves and get to work. And there, you can't judge this, for a couple of years, quite frankly.
Well, and I tried to drive home the point that whenever there has been a pronounced, you know, crisis, as it were, the response has really been successful. And the one that I point to most readily, and you've been somebody that's been tied in with the aftercare, when there was the unnecessary attack on the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, and you know, there was this immediate outcry and ridicule from everywhere about you know, how the industry is looking after horses. You know, there had been this sort of patchwork series of groups that were looking to acquire and place second career thoroughbreds in various different, you know, different directions. And the creation of the Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance has been a mammoth success. And you know, so when people say, oh, the industry and oh, these alphabet organizations, the Satish used to call it the alphabet soup, the TAA is a home run. It's been nothing but impactful on a successful basis. That's a perfect example.
Well, let's balance that out, right? The TAA has been an incredible home run. It responded to an industry need, and if you look at where we are on retirement today as to where we were 10 years ago, incredible success story, okay? It's great. So it shows that when the industry is properly motivated, properly organized, and has the right people doing the work on the ground, it can do its job. Now, on the other hand, let's be perfectly honest with ourselves and look in the mirror, and that too many of our safety, medication, et al. Issues, we have not made progress fast enough. People have not been willing, to cede their own authority. And it's an area that's come to the fore now, and I think that's what the tracks are showing. Hey, we need to move faster and work quicker and be more unified on this. And we're going to find out, Steve, what's going to happen over the next couple of years is, can we move that ball forward quicker? Can we up the tempo, right? Are we going to be the 1990 New York Knicks and go slow? Or are we going to be the 2010 Golden State Warriors and play fast? And, you know, that remains to be seen, but I see the announcement from a couple days ago as a step in the right direction.
You know, one thing that when we talk about the various capacities and you know, all the parallel tracks that operate in the sport. And I recall that when, you know, you came on to run NYTHA after Rick, and you were asked about the pressing concerns, you didn't talk about aftercare, you didn't talk about infrastructure, you didn't talk about the Lasix, you talked about the horse player. That was the first thing that you called attention to, and it did seem to me the other day that that was an absentee aspect. I mean, that is you know, with all these crises, the biggest, longest running crises is a quality product priced right.
You know, the way I see it is, it's all intertwined. If we, from the horse player's perspective, they want to see horses on the track, right? And we want to see horses on the track. We want to see horses run frequently. We want them to have long careers. We want them to prosper and be healthy. And that serves the number one issue that, that horse players talk about, to me, is the short fields, right? And, you know, this is all part and parcel of the same thing. It's very difficult, and we probably need to find ways to do it, but it's extremely difficult to include horse players in this kind of safety conversation because, quite honestly, who are you talking to about it, right? It's hard. It's not that there aren't guys that couldn't contribute. There's probably, especially on the statistical analysis side, a lot we could learn from horse players about how to identify horses at risk or horses that aren't going to run well, right? That we just don't tap into right now. But, you know, these things are, it's hard to satisfy everyone.
Well, in the role that you're enjoying, that's very true. But doing a super job, Joe, and I, you know, I know that it's so easy for you know those that want to critique from afar and you know who are not literally on the front lines dealing with this on a daily basis, but you are, and you know, these are hard issues, and it's a complex business.
It's a complex business that's been rooted in the past for way too long. If you think about so much of what we do and why we do it, and we never question it because it's always the way it's been done or it's the quaint way of doing it, and that's fine. That's often what makes it beautiful and wonderful, and the fact that I know exactly when the Alabama is going to be in Saratoga and, you know, when the seats still have, the seats are still wooden and wobbly. It's wonderful. But in this modern world with complex systems and a complex game, and as we shoehorn this agricultural product into a modern television and entertainment environment, like, you know, these parts bump up against each other, and it's not so clear and easy what all the fixes are. If it were so, you know, we probably would have done them. And I think this is a reckoning a long time coming. And it's going to be healthy for us in the long run, but there's a lot of work to be done in the short term in terms of modernizing the game and whether, and it touches on both our topics, whether it's complying with laws in a state like New York or California as to payroll and work hours, or whether it's ensuring the health and welfare of the animals we love. And, you know, it's not easy, but we have to do the work. We don't have a choice. Otherwise, we won't be here.
Well said, Joe. Well done. Off the hooks, Joe Applebaum. How was your season, by the way, for bloodstock trade?
Selling, it was just okay, but we've had some real good runners. We had Lazy Daisy come out of the sale. She won the stakedown at the Breeders' Cup. We had City Man, who's one of the better New York breds, won a stake up at Saratoga. So we've had some nice success come out of the sales this year.
Joe Applebaum, everybody, who is leading the Horsemen in New York, and well in hand here. Joe, thanks so much for this.
Steve, my pleasure. Always great to talk to you.
Joe Applebaum, everybody, and addressing the issues of the day and the week, and the topic, of course, that was another opportunity for the outside world to to ridicule racing. We do provide them with seemingly a lot of opportunity. Let's take the bottom of the hour break, and we'll come back. Rich Eng, and we're so remiss, 2 weeks behind with Rich. So looking forward to conversation. Rich Eng next.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Rauschbills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Rauschbills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Rauschbills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Rauschbills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Get started in Kentucky. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start.
DRF Sports Forum Digital Edition, your ultimate weekly betting guide. Published by Daily Racing Form, DRF Sports Forum delivers all of the analysis and insight you need for every NFL game and more than 40 college football matchups. Beat the spread with powerful trends and sharp angles. Tap into best bets, expert picks, parlay winners, and more. All for just $4.99 per issue. Get this week's edition free. Visit drf.com/sportsforum. Enter code DRF Sports.
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Do you ever wonder what happens to your old friends, including the great champions that inspired unforgettable memories, and maybe even let you cash a ticket or two over the years? We even have a former child prodigy.
Here is a superstar. That horse's name is Afternoon Delights, and kept the song on Afternoon Delights absolutely galloping in the Hollywood Futurities.
These are the champions that help out the horses that might not have won a Grade 1 race, but always tried just as hard. Come visit them all at Old Friends when you're in Kentucky or at our Bobby Frankel division, Old Friends in Saratoga. I know they'll be glad to see you. Go to oldfriendsequine.org or call us at 502-863-1775.
Sirius XM Radio.
Your feet in the air and your head on the ground. Try this trick and spin it, yeah. Your head will collapse, there's nothing in it. And you ask yourself, where is my mind? Where is my mind? Where is my mind?
We're back at the races, about 20 couple minutes plus, close out this Thursday. Rich Yang is going to join us, and in all of the hubbub leading up to Breeders' Cup, and then these last 2 weeks where, I mean, only talked to Juan Carlos Guerrero yesterday. There's still people we haven't even talked to yet, but I wanted to get to Rich and get his aftermath and catch up with him here ahead of Thanksgiving week. Rich, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve. And thank you for having me come on before Christmas, before Thanksgiving, I mean, because this gives me an opportunity to wish a happy Thanksgiving to all the folks, all the listeners out there, with you and Tina. And I hope everybody has a wonderful, wonderful holiday next week.
Well, and the same for you. And Sandy, and did you get a new puppy? Did I see you got a new puppy?
Well, it's our third Lily, but we've always picked up rescues, and they're always picked up Yorkies. So we've had this Lily for actually 3 years now.
Oh, okay. I thought I saw. Yeah.
But she's a, you know, I put a picture of her on my Facebook. She's much better looking than me. So.
Well, I don't know why I thought somebody lost a dog. I must be conflating two circumstances. Somebody had lost a dog, and then they got a new one, and it was a lassie situation, basically replacing one that looked just like the previous one.
Yeah, every one of our Yorkies has been named Lily, so
that's pretty funny.
Dogs are very adaptable. They learn their names pretty quickly and keep repeating it.
That's pretty funny, actually. It makes it easy to, you don't call the dog by the wrong name. It's different when you're a cat owner. It's different, you know. The cats come into your life from all crazy ways. I mean, we got one at the place where I get my hair cut. They delivered one on us. One showed up at the doorstep. Two I got off the racetrack at the end of a season at Saratoga. And they, you know, you get whatever you get when you bring cats into your life.
Well, one thing about us, Steve, and I know this goes for a lot of listeners out there, you know, the fact that we love horses is a wonderful thing, but it kind of extends further through the animal lineage. We love animals overall, too, but horses certainly are at the top of our list.
Well, let's go through your list of performances, and I already had told people right after Breeders' Cup, I know that you had one opinion that absolutely was a hit for you mid-card Saturday at Breeders' Cup, and that was Iridesa. I know you liked.
Yeah, Iridesa was my top choice in the turf race for Joseph O'Brien, and it's great how the Acorn doesn't fall too far off the tree because his father, Aiden O'Brien, obviously Hall of Fame trainer. But it was a horse that I really liked, you know, coming into the race. And, you know, a lot of times when we handicap the Breeders' Cup races and we take a look at the European contingents, a lot of times the ones who obviously are coming out of a majority of Group 1 races will get the most publicity. But I found a lot of success when you take a look at the horses that maybe are getting a little underrated, you know, to some degree, whether they may have been running in Group 2 stakes. But a lot of times the ones who don't get talked about a lot are the ones who run big on the Breeders' Cup. So, you know, I would hope that your listeners may make a mental note for that for next year's Breeders' Cup is, you know, the obvious horses are obvious, the ones that are always getting talked up coming over from England or France or whatever. But a lot of times the upset winner is the ones who don't get the mention and just kind of sneak in there on us.
That's fair. And then there's the other side of the coin, which is the ones that you get beat over the head with. And you start to think, you know, there's got to be something to it. For the most part, I don't know if I've done this, Rich, consciously, but I've tried to, you know, kind of, you know, not be drawn in one direction or another. You know, a lot of times, you know, I need, when it came to like a Goldikova, you know, I didn't have to be convinced. You know, I found it easy to, you know, to acquiesce to how good and enable to last year. I mean, I bought in.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of times they run as good as advertised, which is great because if, you know, they're getting all the verbal support and the marketing support and the betting support, it's nice to see them run the way people think they're supposed to run. But I know when I take a look at some of these Europeans come over, you know, one thing I try to take a look at is if maybe they're coming over because they like firmer ground versus softer ground that they run up in a lot on over there. And if that's the case and the trainer has a, you know, an extra card up his sleeve and even something as simple as the fact that a lot of these horses run first time on Lasix in the U.S., you know, I know Lasix is not considered a performance enhancer, but it's still, you know, we see in a lot of cases where first time Lasix does help an animal run just a little bit closer to its potential, you know. So,
sure.
You know, there's small things that we look at to try to boost a horse's stock in our eyes as far as whether we want to play that horse or not.
Agreed. And I mean, that, and that's also, you know, that can be applied Monday through Sunday when we're, you know, on everyday racing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because, you know, like, you know, I kind of, when I take a look at, like, for example, Steve, a field of first-time starters that are, like, all two-year-olds, and I see, like, say, for example, there's a field of 10 two-year-old first-time starters, and you see, like, nine of them running on Lasix, and I'm thinking to myself, not all of these horses are bleeders or are proven to be bleeders. I mean, they're just using the rules and regulations of racing as, you know, as they're written in the books. But, you know, sometimes you see, you know, two-year-olds that start without using Lasix for the first race or two, and then the trainer makes a decision to switch over to Lasix. And sometimes you see an improvement, which is, you know, part of trying, as I said, to run to potential versus, and also still within the regulations of the sport.
Oh, no doubt. And you know, that part of it, you know, you think about, I'm trying to think of, Kenny McPeak. McPeak is a guy who may run a horse once, twice, even three times without, and then, you know, whether it's first time as a three-year-old, you know, Kenny is taken that tact. Graham Motion occasionally, I've seen. Uh-huh. You know, Graham might start one without, and then, and you know, I mean, this is a whole separate discussion.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, but for people that they're saying, well, you know, if they're all using it, you know, aren't people doing it defensively? Well, yeah, you're doing it defensively because you don't want to. It used to be that you'd have to prove that your horse bled, and that's how you'd get the opportunity to use Lasix. And you don't want your horse to experience bleeding. I mean, they all have to, you know, some degree, they're all going to have EIPH, and so when they're in stressful conditions, I mean, that's when you want to give them every, you know, every advantage you can, and so to me, I can understand why there's the debate, but it just, to me, it seems, you know, it's an inexpensive, effective way to, you know, help the horse and keep the horse from, you know, from,
you know, and also
suffering it.
Yeah, and also, like a lot of the turf horses we see come over from Europe, a lot of times the horse might have bled over in a race in France or England, but certainly has ability, and then they ship the horse to the U.S. where the Lasix can help them perform to their abilities versus what happened over there.
Exactly right. Back to some of the, you know, some of the hits and misses. And in fact, tomorrow, speaking of hits and misses, Brad Anderson's going to visit with us tomorrow, who won the BCBC and got a chance to finally connect with Brad for a conversation. We talked to Dick Girardi yesterday or Tuesday, which was a lot of fun. Rich, some other, you know, things that went right and some things maybe that you'd like to have another chance at.
Well, I can say this, that the day after the Breeders' Cup on Sunday, which was the closing day of the fall meet at Santa Anita, you know, that was a mandatory payout, and the pick six, and I know the pick six didn't pay a whole lot, but it was certainly havable, and I had it a couple of times. It paid like $1,004, but you know, in my mind, Steve, when there's big carryovers, like, for example, there's one coming up on Sunday at Gulfstream Park West, you know, I know it's, you know, the publicity wheels like to have, like, one winner winning $3 million or $2 million, something like that. But I've always taken the tack that what's better for the industry and for the horse players is if a lot of people share. Because when you think about it, all the people that put money into the pools chasing, if it all goes into one pocket, well, you know, in a way, that's great for the one person if you're the guy who makes the score. But all the other people get zip. And, you know, I still think it's healthier for the sport if a lot of people who invest actually get paid back. So I'd rather see mandatory payouts that are shared by many versus just a few.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, that's to be honest, one of the real elements of what transpired with the evolution of the Rainbow Six. Those early distribution days, Rich, where they thought that it was somehow to the concept's advantage to make it as impossible as possible, you know, to make it 12 by 14 by 12 by 12 by 11 by 14, like that, like that was going to be the best thing for, you know, all the people whose backs the jackpot was built on. When in fact, you'd be much better off, making sure that there were a couple of places people could go narrow and could, get away with either a single or just a couple of includes, so that the small people who had been playing it all along would have a fighting chance, as opposed to, the big barn, the big ticket players and the big syndicates, that were putting together monster plays. And, you absolutely want the money spread back out, because the other big problem with the bet continues to be that this money is being held captive and being kept out of circulation and out of the churn. And there's no way to put put lipstick on that pig.
That's very true. Also, I've had this philosophical argument with a lot of horse players. I don't know if I'm on the right side or the wrong side of this issue, Steve, but I'm of the opinion that when the carryover, the jackpot grows into high six figures, $500,000, $700,000, whatever the cutoff point in the person's personal decision-making might be, that I think it's actually worth going after, not to try to get the unique ticket, but the fact is, so many syndicates are putting in big tickets that there's a lot of fat, so to speak. There's a lot of room to skim, and if a player like me, some others might put in a smaller ticket in the $20, $40, $60 range, well, I'd be thrilled to hit the pick six and get paid back $1,000 or $1,500 versus somebody who's shooting for the moon. And right. I've had people argue the reverse, saying, "Well, you're still feeding into the 50% takeout." And this kind of stuff. So I don't know which one's right or wrong, but I think it's open for discussion.
Well, and on this topic, and literally have been discussing this with people like Paul Matisse and Andy Serling and Maury Wolf and, some of the sharpest minds in the game about the financials and about, the way this is leveraged. And the unusual part about that growth period when these jackpots reach a certain critical mass, there is the argument to be made that there are so many extraneous combinations being covered that it does help soften the outlandish two-layer takeout. And, that was brought out, I think, Maury Wolf, when we first started discussing this, when this became, a real, raging hot topic, as the thing started to, enter the consciousness. And I think Maury made that point, and Paul did too, and Andy, that there is a way to figure out a certain point when, this thing is still onerous, and its principles are still wrong, but it's not as wart covered in this scenario as it is, the first 3 weeks while the pot is building.
Yeah, because when the pot's building and it gets to that, I love the term you used of critical mass, but when it's certainly sweet enough for people to go after and try to get that unique ticket, they have to throw in a lot of bombs to try to have separation where, say a $60 or $80 horse wins and most everybody gets knocked out and they're still alive. I mean, you have to have scenarios like that to try to get the unique ticket. And obviously most of those horses will not win, but that money goes into the pool. And if a player like me on a smaller level can kind of skim off the top and we get a formful day where maybe the biggest winner of the six races is $14, you know, I might be able to figure out, you know, those six winners that are in the either favorites or mid-priced range and come away with a nice little score for a small amount of money.
Well, no racing today at Del Mar, Rich, and the, you know, the advance concept of canceling the Thursday card today, the weather did in fact come as you know, advertised, and so I'm sure that, you know, they feel justified and happy that they did what they did. So no Del Mar today, but the weekend, actually the Saturday card looks pretty attractive, and you must have found something to play today. No.
Well, I tell you what, I'm going to give out two high-priced runners at Aqueduct, and if I can get one of them home, I will be over the moon, but they're both price plays. Let's go to race number three at Aqueduct. It's a mile and a 16th on the grass. I'm assuming they're still on the grass today at Aqueduct.
Yeah, only the first. The first is off, but other than that, everything else is fine.
Okay, well, I'm going to Chad Brown has horses in the two races I'm looking at, and they're both going to be bet big, obviously, as Chad Brown usually gets. Here's the first bomb is the number five horse, Alvernia, at 8-1 for Gary Siaka.
That's my man.
This horse has shown me some ability on grass, and I think is improving. And at 8-1, I think I'm willing to give this horse a chance and throw the horse maybe in some exotic combinations to close under Eric Cancel. Chad Brown, obviously, is the favorite in there. And in the sixth race, another grass route. Again, Chad Brown has got the favorite. And the horse that I'm going to give a shot to is the number two, Mobridge, at 15-1. I know you like that, Steve. I'm sure that's a good tune up your alley. But this is a dead closer, and the jockey Vargas coming in from Maryland. I guess he might be trying New York for the wintertime, but he's a pretty talented kid. And this horse has been going off at you know, some good prices, but I think this is a closer too, so hopefully get a pace scenario where Vargas can close well in the stretch. But this horse will be 15-1, the two, Mobridge, in the sixth race.
Well, and Mobridge has got a little bit of tactical foot. I mean, can certainly be placed advantageously, and whenever Mobridge's name comes up, I always bring out the trivia that's attached to it, because the horse originally was with our friend Lee Einsiedler and trained by Bill Mott, and there was a direct connection, of course, because Mobridge is Bill Mott's hometown.
Oh, okay. Very good.
That's that, and Lee named Mobridge in honor of of Mobridge, South Dakota. So that's where that comes from. And, you know, it's funny. Alvernia is an interesting pick, too. Our Minute Mouse and Alvernia both were looking at this race, and Gary ended up going ahead with Alvernia here, and we're running Saturday in the third, which ended up being we kind of were worried that this was going to be a tough spot. Well, too tough. That spot is maybe even tougher, as it turns out, a state bred allowance. This is an open company starter allowance, and it's damn tough. So, Alvernia's okay. This is a competitive race.
Yeah, you know, a lot of it obviously is price. This horse may go off at higher than 8-1, which is okay by me. I'm just looking for this horse, hopefully to outrun his odds and to get in the money. I'll probably link up with some other horses in exact accommodations and hope for the best on getting Alvernia with a good trip.
The horse next to her, too, Overheated from Ray Handel, is okay with Rosario, 10-1. This, you're absolutely right to pick this race out as a place to try to sniff out a price play, and all of Rich's analysis for Southern California, of course, at racedaylasvegas.com and on big days at Brisnet. I'll throw in a horse at Churchill today. That seventh race that starts the late pick four. This is a first level allowance. It's a turf sprint, and you know turf sprints are mercurial, to say the least. I thought that. The seven, I thought, declined from Mike Maker that race two back. He runs back to that. He's okay in here. And there's actually a big price that I was going to use underneath. I'm going to use the 5, who's 20-1. Get Some Mo from John Enos. I'm going to use that one underneath as well. So you got some action today, everybody. And my action is off to Bennington, Vermont, for a haircut. My first haircut is a 60-year-old. Rich, thanks so much. Rich Eng, everybody. And you follow Rich. Rich Eng at ProPick. Not at ProPick. For ProPick. Excuse me. Rich Eng for ProPick at Twitter. And RaceDayLasVegas.com. Want to thank Joe Applebaum and Steve Askin, of course, and the one and only Tommy Skiffington, the Skiff Dog. HRRN coverage today of Churchill and Aqueduct and more. Weekend preview tomorrow, including BCBC winner Brad Anderson. Probably some Marty McGee and some Jay Privman. Maybe some Mike Welch, Nick Tamaro and Hammer and more. Jeff Siegel. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.